Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dave Whitlock, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Oklahoma and fly fishing. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. The broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dave Whitlock about why he moved to Oklahoma and many other fly fishing topics. Our approach is simple. Education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Dave, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, go to our homepage, and in Dave's section there, you'll see a link that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and then we'll announce the winners at the end of the show on the drawings. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. Their website is www.frontrangeanglers.com. And here's how you win that. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be something about what we talked with Dave about tonight. And the first person to submit the right answer gets the $20 gift certificate, which you can redeem online or in their store. You got to pay attention, and you use that text box on the homepage where you submit questions during the show. That's where you'll submit your answers to this question at the end of the show. So I'll go over that again at the end of the show, but pay attention, and I hope one of you wins that tonight. Well, our guest tonight is Dave Whitlock. Dave Whitlock is one of the most well-known and highly respected individuals in the world of fly fishing. He's a native Oklahoman who 35 years ago resigned his position as a research chemist and pooled his talents in painting, illustrating, writing and photography, fly fishing and lecturing to embark on a new career as a full-time professional in the arts of fly fishing. All his works, especially his art, reflect the realism of nature and related fly fishing subjects through the eyes of the sportsman. His diversity has always taken him to new creative directions, including, in recent years, trout stream design and restoration. Dave regularly contributes his fly fishing art, photography, and writing to many publications such as Fly Fisherman Magazine, Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, Trout Magazine, In Fisherman, and Field and Stream. He has written and illustrated 4 books, Dave Whitlock's Guide to Aquatic Trout Food, the L.L. Bean Fly Fishing Handbook, the L.L. Bean Bass Fly Fishing Handbook, and Imitating and Fishing Natural Fish Foods for Lefty's Little Library. Dave has also co-authored many or made contributions to many other books. He also demonstrates his fly fishing and teaching skills in 7 videos and through guest appearances on televised fly fishing programs. Dave's experience and his devoted and objective outlook on the whole spectrum of fly fishing has earned him consulting assignments from top companies such as 3M Scientific Anglers, Bass Pro, Sage Rods, and Sims Fly Fishing Gear. He designed and directed the first 10 years of the L.L. Bean Fly Fishing Schools. Dave is a recipient of many awards, including the Max Anders Wild Trout Award in 1976 for his work on propagation of wild trout and the FFF's Conservation Man of the Year Award in 1981. Dave and his wife Emily, after living near the White River in Arkansas and conducting their fly fishing school there for several years, have just recently moved back to Oklahoma in the Ozark Mountains near Tahlequah. There, they continue to teach privately and pursue their writing, art, and stream work projects. Dave Whitlock is a man totally devoted to the world of fly fishing and conservation, both professionally and personally. Dave, I'm honored to have you as a guest on our show tonight. Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, hi, Roger. Good to be here.
Well, that was...
I'm anxious to get to talking.
you want me to quit talking and you want to start. Okay,
no,
I get it.
Well,
okay.
Either way, you know. That's
well, that's why we have here, and you've got, as I figure it, at least another, almost 85 minutes to talk. So we're going to let you talk a lot tonight, Dave.
Okay.
Well, let's answer the big question first. Why did you move back to Oklahoma?
Well, it was, I guess it was sort of divine intervention. You know, of course, I moved to Arkansas not because I disliked Oklahoma, but because it was a little bit more opportunity there for cold water fishing for a budding fly fishing professional. It seemed to be a better choice, and it was. And we loved our life there a great deal. But an old friend came back into my life that I taught how to hunt and fish when we were in the junior high and high school, and we rebonded. And while I was visiting him here at his ranch in Oklahoma, he showed me a little stream that looked like it had a great deal of possibility to turn into a trout stream, plus an incredible home that his partner at the ranch had died and left. And one thing led to another, and now we live in that incredible home, and we developed a beautiful trout stream that runs through the backyard. And most people who say, why we moved to Oklahoma, once they come here and see where we live and how we live here, say, I would never walk back through that gate again. I'd stay right here the rest of my life if I were you, Dave.
Sounds wonderful. And
well,
of course,
it's paradise.
Anytime you have a stream going through the backyard, I mean, what more can you want?
Well, one other thing, and that is a really nice bluegill pond. And so as soon as we agreed to move here, we dug a pond, about a two-acre pond that circles our house on two sides. So we've got a bluegill pond on two sides of the house. On the other side of the house, we've got a trout stream.
Wow.
I know it's wonderful.
And like you, I think you told me earlier, it's the topography around there isn't what most of us, like me in the Rocky Mountains, would think of Oklahoma.
No.
I mean, I think of Oklahoma as flat land with oil derricks on it.
Well, that's
it's not
about,
that way at all, is it?
That's about, you know, two-thirds of it, of the central and western part of Oklahoma is that way. But all of the eastern border of Oklahoma is heavily mountained by three different mountain ranges: the Kimmage Mountains, the Ouachita Mountains, and the Ozark Mountains. And so it's very mountainous, and we get about 40 to 50 inches of rainfall here a year. So there's a lush aquifer coming out of those mountains that generates an awful lot of beautiful spring creeks and freestone streams, not to mention just an unbelievable amount of reservoirs.
Well, I just, Dave, one thing I didn't tell you earlier is I do get live questions coming in over the Internet as we're talking, so
sure. Uh-huh.
I will interject those here where I think they're appropriate. Yeah. I did get a kind of a personal message here. Sid Carradine in Columbus, he says, Dave, the MSFF are listening tonight. Captain Sid, I guess you know him. So.
Yeah, cool, yes.
So just a little note to pass on. And then another personal note, Mac and Julia Carradine, and they said they miss you living in Arkansas. Tell Emily hello.
Oh, that's sweet of you. Okay,
yeah.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, so that's always nice.
You know, we miss Arkansas, too. We love it there just as much as we always have. And fortunately, we get back there about once a month to do some clinics and to fish the White River and hug and be with some of our wonderful friends there.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's only about a five-hour drive back over there, 200 miles straight east. And so we're still very bonded and close to there. That's a great, great area to fish in and to vacation anyway. So, and when I lived here in Oklahoma, I literally would drive over to the White River area once or twice a month for about 10 or 12 years. So I didn't, you know, so we're just doing it the other way now again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things that is near you now, too, is the Illinois River, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but
okay.
Before we get to that, because that's another reason to be in Oklahoma, too, right?
Yeah, well, it's a big reason,
But before we get to that, can you give us just a little background about how you got started in fly fishing? Because we all get started different ways, and
sure.
You've been doing this a long time, but can you give us a little history?
Well, actually, you know, Oklahoma, when I was a child, was basically the Sahara Desert for fly fishing. Until I was about 14 or 15 years old, I never even heard or saw another fly fisherman. But when I was about 9 years old, I discovered fly fishing through an L.L. Bean catalog my granddad had. And we were, you know, I wasn't born with a fly rod in my hand, but I was born almost with a fish rod in my hand because all of my parents and grandparents fished a lot. But they used relatively crude tackle, cane poles, and metal bait casting rods, and for the most part bait, things like, you know, shrimp and earthworms and beef melt and chicken entrails and that sort of thing. And when I discovered that people caught fish on beautiful feather imitations on long bamboo rods, I thought, now that sounds to me like the kind of way I want to catch a fish. And so at 9 years old, I begged my dad into buying me a used fly rod he found in a pawn shop up in Iowa. He was a construction welder. And he brought the rod home to me. It was probably a 9 foot, 7 or 8 weight bamboo rod was in kind of a state of ill repair. But it had a little fly reel attached to it that was rusted. I remember that. And a level old silk line without a leader on it. And that was my first tackle. And I struggled with it for several years, but I caught fish. I guess probably I caught almost as many on my back cast as I did on my forecast, because the reason for that was that, first of all, I couldn't cast very well at all. In fact, my folks wouldn't even let me in the boat with them whenever I was slinging that thing around. But I learned if I waded out to about belly button deep in a pond or a creek, I could get the fly out far enough to catch a fish. Well, doing that, my back cast often hit the water behind me, and it really was a back cast, more so than average, I guess. And I'd actually catch fish, you know, behind me, and I'd start to make my forward cast, and I'd have a fish on. So, and it didn't bother me the least bit. I thought that was pretty cool, catching fish on both directions.
Yeah, I guess that is pretty cool. It reminds me of the same way I started. I started fly fishing in a pond and wading out there in my shorts up to my chest and fishing for largemouth bass, and that's how I started too. But
it's a great way to start, I'll tell you.
Yeah, a lot of fun, a lot of good memories. You worked then for quite a few years as a research chemist. How did you make the switch to going in the world of fly fishing industry?
Well, Roger, of course, art and fishing and stuff was just my passion from the time I was a child on. You know, a lot of young people nowadays, I guess, grow up without a true passion, but I can never remember a time in my younger life that I didn't want to involve myself in art and fishing, you know, as a profession. But I asked my folks if it was okay if I majored in art and journalism in college. I was the first person in my family who had an opportunity to get a higher education, and they just got so upset with it. So they said, you know, that you don't have any talent. People who are in that area of work, usually the first people to starve in a depression, which we had just came out of and almost starved in. And so like a good son, I took their advice, and I got degrees in chemistry and physics and biology and went to work in research. But I always kept that passion, and every chance I had, you know, I'd learned everything I could about fishing. And I would write incessantly letters and essays and what have you. And so I just self-taught myself the art, you know, and fly fishing and writing and how to use a camera and everything. And so when I was 35, I was beginning to sell some stuff and get pretty good at it, I thought. I look back at it now and I was pretty amateurish, but you know how that is. And I left my research job and worked – you know, went to work as a full-time, you know, independent or professional. And so freelancing like that was pretty tough for a few years, but my wife helped me because she had a job, and then also I sold a lot of flies. I was a good fly tyer, and I sold a lot of flies, and that kind of kept our head above the water until we began to make a living on my writing and my artwork and teaching, et cetera.
Right, right.
I think it was pretty scary at first, though.
Oh, yeah, it always is.
But
yeah,
you know, the most wonderful thing about self-employment is you have freedom, and you don't have to show up at in an office job every day. You can set your own hours, and you can work and do what you please without having to get permission from someone to do that or to pursue a new idea. And I'd encourage anybody in this wonderful country to start their own business or do their own work if they have any initiative at all, because it's such a great way to live your life.
Yes, I agree. I agree. I've been the same way throughout my life, and I never have a lack of new ideas to pursue, so it's always very interesting. And you've got so many talents, and I saw you at the recent show in Denver, and I got to meet you there, and Dave, I was just impressed in the fact that somebody was buying a book from you and the time you took to just do a little illustration in the front of that cover, which you didn't have to do, and it told me right then and there that you really enjoy drawing.
Well, I do. And you know, also, it's my way of getting to spend a personal moment with someone who cares enough to be interested in my work. And to me, it's a small thing to be able to, do someone a nice inscription that way with a little sketch on it. And I know how much it would mean to me if someone did that for me, if I was asking them to sign their book.
Well, that was really impressed me. And did you say that you didn't have any formal instruction on
No, not art? Really. I had high school art, and I won a couple of contests. In fact, one international contest while I was in high school. But no, past that point, I'd given anything if I could have, gone on and studied, art in college or in an art school. But that didn't happen. But on the other hand, I'm satisfied with the progress that I've made.
Oh yeah, I would hope so, because you're an excellent artist. And anyone out there listening, if you do not have Dave's book, Guide to Aquatic Trout Foods, you have to get that book for a number of reasons, not only to see some of Dave's, really fine drawings, but also for the knowledge about aquatic trout foods. I go back to that book, Dave, again and again and again. And
well, thank you. I'm real proud of that book because that it served the purpose that I wrote it for and illustrated for, and that is to take the average person who wanted to get into this sport and make it pleasant for them to learn about what fish feed on and how to identify those food forms and how to imitate them. And there are a lot of other books that are a lot more detailed and a lot more complicated, but the Aquatic Trout Foods book, I think, takes most people as far as they need to go to become excellent fly fishermen in respect to being able to imitate what a fish wants to eat.
Yeah, I agree. And it's timeless information, too. I don't know when you published that book, but there isn't a season I don't go by when I don't go back to that for reference for one reason or another.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, so everybody, you need to get that book if you don't have that book. Well, I need to take a short break here, Dave,
okay.
And we'll be back in about 30 seconds, and let's talk about the Illinois River.
No,
at Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species as well. Please tour our website, www.dryflies.com, to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Whitlock about his world of fly fishing. If you would like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And, folks, I just want to tell you we really do appreciate you submitting questions. Sometimes they come in and I hold them for a while till later in the show where they're more appropriate, but please do participate. It makes it very interesting for us as well. Well, Dave, let's talk a little bit about the Illinois River, because you impressed me when you told me your grand slam, so to speak, there was 17 varieties of fish in one day.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Can you just kind of give us a, you know, first of all, where in the world is the Illinois River?
Well, the Illinois River, its headwaters up at Fayetteville, Arkansas, and it loops down into Oklahoma and heads across the northeastern part of Oklahoma south and runs into the Arkansas River just above Fort Smith. And it's a beautiful stream. It looks a lot like the Buffalo River in Arkansas. It's a beautiful, turquoise stream that's floatable for about 80 miles. And it's really a nice river. It also has quite a large reservoir, a 10-killer reservoir, which has substantially changed the character of that river after they built that lake, because it stopped, you know, some of the migratory fish runs. But for the most part, it's a fantastic fishery, because the upper end of it is basically cool and warm water fishing for smallmouth bass and largemouth and spotted bass and sunfish, etc. Below the dam at 10 Killer, it's basically a cold water tailwater fishery for about 7 or 8 miles. And then the last 2 miles before it intersects with the Arkansas River navigational system and river, it's kind of a cold water fishery going to a cool water fishery into a warm water fishery, and it attracts huge numbers of all kinds of species of fish that live in that massive, you know, navigation system up into that cool or cold water in the summer and the winter time.
Well, it sounds like you said 80 miles of floatable river, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, is that without interruption there, or is that?
Well, the lake, of course, is, you know, there, but the upper portion of it, though, is where you could float down to approximately Tahlequah, and then you'd have to, you know, go the 10-killer lake's about 28 miles long, and then you go, you know, below the dam there, and you've got another 8 or 9 miles of floatable water there.
Okay, so we've got multiple cold water fisheries there then.
Well, just one cold water fishery, just right below the dam, you have the 7 or 8 miles of. And that's stocked with rainbow and brown trout. And I would say that it's a reasonably good fishery. The problem, though, is why it's never developed into a great fishery, is the predation of the fish that come up the river from the Arkansas River Channel, mainly striped bass. Very large striped bass run up that river, and they forage on the trout that have been stocked there, unmercifully. And a 15 or 16-inch stocked rainbow doesn't have a chance with a 40-pound striper, after him.
Wow. One of the questions came in here from David Rowlett in Texas. What is the best time of year to fish for stripers on the lower Illinois?
Well, my personal best time is from about now till September. That's when the warm water the cold water of the Illinois River coming out of the dam, you know, hits the warm water of the Arkansas River, and the strippers, you know, come up that cold water fishery. It's also good in the winter, but it seems to be a little bit more of a conventional tackle and bait fishing scenario then, when the strippers come, you know, up out of the cold water river, which is the Arkansas River gets cold in the winter, into to the little bit milder cold water of the Illinois River. Because it can be like, you know, 35, 40 degrees in the Arkansas River, and some ice on it sometimes, and then when the water's coming out of 10-killer, you know, dam, it can be 55, 56 degrees for the 7 or 8 miles, and so that's quite an attraction to the fish. But I have not had the luck, or you know, the consistent fishing for the cooler and warm water fish there in the winter that I have had in the summer when they're coming up there to find that cooler water.
Well, this is a continuation of David's question. He wants to know, is it fishing any better when they're generating electricity or at minimum flow?
If you're after trout, minimum flow is the best. If you are after the stripers and the white bass and the hybrids and the walleyes and the Kentuckys and the largemouth and the channel cat and the drum and the skipjack and what have you, when they've got both generators on, it's best.
Interesting.
Because they're stimulated by that flow.
Yeah.
And at that time, I need to say, too, that it's not wading water. It's you have to have a powerboat, usually, to negotiate that river, you know, safely at that point.
Now, is that the case in all parts of that river? Is it all powerboat, no drift boat activity?
Well, you can drift it, but the thing is that a lot of times having, an outboard motor on a boat gives you a lot more latitude of where you can fish. You can go upstream or downstream or et cetera, you know.
Okay.
But you can drift it, but I prefer to use a powerboat. I have a 22-foot White River John boat with a 15-horsepower motor on it that will go in very, you know, very swift rough water as well as very shallow, you know, slow water. And that's the way that boat's designed. And so it's a perfect craft no matter what kind of water conditions we get in on the river.
Mm-hmm. Now, he also, he had a lot of parts to his question.
He's
like also asking,
getting ready to come up and fish.
Yeah. What flies for the stripers? Any favorites you have there?
Yeah, you know, first of all, the stripers feed on trout and skipjack and gizzard shad and crawfish, and kind of in that order. And we usually use probably on the average 1-aught to 3-aught streamer flies that imitate either, you know, the shad or the small trout, and fish them on a sink tip or full sinking line depending on how heavy the water is. Also, if you want to catch lots of small stripers, the daytime's the better time. If you want to catch the larger stripers, usually from sundown till sunup, in other words, fishing more in very low light levels.
Right. Kind of the way a lot of fish are, huh?
Yeah.
The larger fish come out at night. Yeah.
Yeah. We were fishing a local river, a tributary to the Illinois, for a couple days this week, and for white bass. The white bass ran on, and it was amazing that we fished almost all day and got maybe one fish an hour, and then at 6:30. We started catching white bass literally almost at every cast. As soon as that sun started down and the light level got low, those fish turned on. And that happens so many times on fishing. It's just as that light level goes down,
right,
or if you can fish a nice dark day, you know, you're going to always do better, particularly on fish that are, you know, that are feeding predaceously.
Yeah, my father lives up in the mountains here near Bailey, Colorado, and there's a little private lake that we have up there. And I'm amazed at dusk to watch the trout come up to, you know,
yeah.
in the 6 inches of water, and they're finning there, and how brave they get when that light level gets low. So, yeah, always interesting. Well, I have to bring up this question that came in over the internet, since you're talking about white bass here.
Uh-huh.
Bill Butts in Springfield, Missouri says he wants to know, is it true Emily?
Bill
what?
Butts? Who is
Bill
who
Butts,
is that?
Yeah.
I never
what?
Heard of such a character. Are you sure
he
that's
wants
not...
to... Come on, let me ask his question. He wants to know if it's true that Emily catches more big white bass than you do on the Illinois River.
She does. for two reasons. I'd a lot rather watch her fish than fish myself. She is so good looking and so charming, and she has got such a beautiful cast that I would be a fool at my age not just to watch her catch white bass.
I take it you know Mr. Butts, huh?
He is like a son to me. I love him. He's a great guy, and he's probably the best white bass fisherman in the state of Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma.
Oh, well, maybe we should get him on the show, huh?
You should. He's a temperate bass expert plus a very charming guy.
Yeah.
Even though he does ask embarrassing questions.
good though. That makes it lively here. Well, let's see. Other questions. So when we're talking about the Illinois River still, is it mainly public water and readily accessible, or is there issues?
It's all public water. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
No problems with that.
No, it's not. It's no problem at all. Plenty of accesses, and you know, there's good boat launches, et cetera, that you need. The only minor problem, or the problem that I find on it, is that there's not a good boat launch directly below the dam. You can carry a canoe in or a drift boat, but as far as a power boat, there's no launches all the way down to a private resort on the lower middle part of the river, and from there on down there's a couple of boat launches, but that's kind of unfortunate just as far as convenience, but there's all kinds of good walking accesses on that upper river.
And certain parts are wadeable in the upper part,
yes,
I take it. Yeah.
On low water, yeah, whenever they're
on low water. Yeah. Now, is that, I know out here we have those issues of you know, dam releases when you can get caught on the other side of the river or something like that,
kind of
unawares.
Well, they blow a whistle, but you know, when you get down river ways, you can't hear it, so you just have to be real careful. In fact, the gentleman that just asked the question, Mr. Butts, coerced me into walking about 2 miles upstream one day, assuring me that there was not going to be any water coming up to find some striper bass in a hole called a car body hole. And so I walked up there with him, and I felt a little bit, you know, apprehensive and a little bit vulnerable being that far up the river and on the wrong side of the river. But, you know, Bill said, according to all of the electronic data that he had accumulated on the Internet, there would be no water rise that morning. Well, we made about 3 casts, and I noticed some foam floating and the water level starting to come up. And so we had to make a 2-mile sprint down the river and cross it before we got safety. And at 73 years old, a 2-mile spent through water waist deep is no fun.
No.
Bill is 6'5", though, and half my age, and so he didn't have a problem, but...
you should have had him carry you across.
Well, then next time I told him, we sat down and we had a little talk, and I said, next time, Bill, when this begins to happen that way, you know, you're going to have to carry me.
Yeah. Guy that big, I mean, that's what he's good for, right?
Yeah. Well, that's all he's good for as far as I'm concerned.
Anybody
that outfishes me like he does, I'm not going to say much kind words to him on it.
There you go.
But, you know, he's a protege, so maybe it's best, you know, that the student is better than the teacher. That's a good thing, I think.
Yeah, I think it is too. I think in any part of life you like to see that happen.
Yeah.
Let's see here. We got Sean Baker in Dallas. He said, thanks for your contributions to our sport. Have you ever fished the lower Mountain Fork River yet? Now, is that in your area?
It's about 150 miles straight south of here.
Okay.
And I have not fished it recently. I fished it whenever the Mountain Fork Dam was first put up. But there's a wonderful trout fishery there now, and I'm anxious to get down there. But it's just, it's quite a drive down, and we've got trout fishing in the backyard here and below Ten Keller and over on the White River. So I really haven't made it a priority to get down there at this point, but I hope to soon because I've heard nothing but good things about it.
Yeah, well, he's giving you looks like a personal invitation to come down and visit him there.
Good.
So.
Well, have him give me a call, and I'll maybe we can work out something.
Yeah.
It's now, Fly Shop, right?
Yeah, Three Rivers Fly Shop. I guess he's Sean's a guide out of there, so sounds like the guy to know down there. Let's see. We've got Kevin McKenna in Plainfield, Illinois. Do you think that the North Fork in Arkansas will ever be a catch-and-release fishery?
Well, I think he's talking about below North Fork Dam. And, you know, I doubt if there'll ever be a catch-and-release fishery, but it's relatively close to being a good a slot limit fishery, which would be just about as practical for that river. But the catch and release thing is really tough simply because of the politics of that fishery there. It's, for its history, it's been a bait fishery, and there's an awful lot of folks, have built up their businesses around that fishery for, you know, a put and take fishery. And, So I think the best compromise is the slot limit thing. People being able to keep a few fish, being able to fish with only artificials, and the fly fishermen will have a much better fishery than as it is now.
Yeah. Now, is that do you think? I don't know. We've got a lot of water out in the west in the Rockies that is catch and release. Is that less prevalent in the Midwest and the area that you're in?
Well, it is. And the reason, you know, of course, is we don't have nearly the trout waters here, but also that an awful lot of the waters that we have here are stocked on a pretty much annual basis. And the way that most people fish here is using either artificials, but mostly bait. And they enjoy power bait and keeping fish. And they're quite a large boating box and they have a right to their way to fish. And when catch and release areas are proposed on a small fishery already, it's awful hard to get those things, done like that.
Yeah. Okay. This is a tough one, and you didn't see this question, but Derek Andrews, Montrose, West Virginia, says, if I'm going to plan a vacation, why should I choose Oklahoma over Montana for trout, Alaska for salmon, or the Bahamas for bonefish? He's asking a lot here.
Well, I can understand his question, and I would say that if he's interested in an extremely, extremely interesting cool and warm water opportunities, Oklahoma would probably be where he should spend a vacation. But if he's mostly interested in cold water fishing, then I certainly Montana or Alaska is certainly the place to go.
Well, now, when we talk about the warmer water fishing there, for instance, on the Illinois, when you go out, do you go out targeting a particular fish during a jaunt on the river? In other words,
usually,
for stripers or smallmouth?
Well, first of all, I actually prefer cool and warm water fishing over cold water fishing on a day-to-day basis. I find it more interesting and more exciting than the trout fishing, particularly if you have to fish an artificial trout river or a river that's crowded. And a lot of the waters here, I will fish sometimes several days without seeing another person and just have wonderful bass bugging or white bass fishing or what have you. And so there's so much more water here that I can fish without being crowded or with large populations of fish that have never seen a fly. And that, to me, is much more appealing than taking a number on a trout stream and sort of standing in line to fish. So.
Yeah, I hear you.
And of course, there are places everywhere you can. If you want to walk far enough or hire the right guide, you can get into waters that are not that way. But on a day-to-day basis, though, when someone's just fishing for the fun of it near their home, this warm and cool water fishing opportunity we have here in Oklahoma is absolutely limitless. I'm just, the chances, if I fish a local smallmouth stream, sometimes I'll catch 8 or 10 different varieties of fish, starting with smallmouth and then spotted bass and largemouth and then rock bass and green sunfish, and bluegill and always catch a drum or two and a catfish or two and maybe sometimes several big carp. And so there's just all kinds of wonderful fish that will hit those smallmouth flies.
Right. So a variety and diversity is the attraction on the Illinois. And I know, even here in Colorado, there's been a lot more activity for warm water fishing, just to get away from the take a number,
That's right.
Beat the crowds kind of thing. And so carp and largemouth are coming on real strong here.
Yeah, and Roger, and I'm not bad-mouthing any kind of fish. They're all wonderful. Hatchery fish are wonderful. But the thing is, though, that 99% of the fish that I catch here in Oklahoma on a fly that are in the cool and warm water class are 100% native fish. They're not stocked. They're self-proliferating. And
right.
I think that's a cool thing, to be able to catch fish that are self-supporting and haven't just been dumped out of a hatchery.
Yeah, and as long as we can maintain that, that's a great thing, both fresh water and salt water.
Yep,
you know?
That's right.
Well, let's see. I have to take a quick break, and I'll be right back, Dave, yep. And we'll talk some more about fly fishing. Flats Time Charters is your sponsor for this segment of our show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. To visit Bob Jaspers, go to flatstimecharters.com, and he'll help you book a trip down there. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Whitlock about his world of fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage. Use that text box on our homepage and ask Dave a question. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on our show tonight. Well, let's just see what we've got here coming in over the Internet. Well, how about if we talk a little bit here, Dave, about flies? Because we do have quite a few questions about flies.
Okay.
And we've got Pete Gramp in Pennsylvania. And he says, in one of your books, Guide to Aquatic Trout Foods, he thinks it was, you list five key factors for what makes an effective fly. He says, I apologize for butchering this as it's from memory, but I recall the order being size, then movement or flowiness, and third, texture. I think the last two are shape and color. Could you kindly restate the list and elaborate on that a bit?
Well, if you look, you know, what are the properties, I guess what you're asking and what I wrote about, what are the properties of a good fly? What makes it really work properly? First of all, I mean, obviously, if a fish is selectively feeding, probably the size is the most important. And right along with the size is the action that you impart or give the fly. Its shape and its color and its texture are the others. And the a fly should have a texture that feels like a natural food form to a fish. There are a lot of flies nowadays that are coming out with very hard bodies or a lot of epoxy on and a lot of glue on, et cetera, or their body itself is molded. And fish, when they hit something like that, particularly the warm and cool water fish, which seem to have a very sensitive mouth to that sort of thing, they eject that very quickly. And so I like a fly that when they grab a hold of it, they feel like they've got to bite a steak rather than a rock.
So that natural movement is really important in the feel and texture.
Well, also, and again, sometimes synthetic materials don't have that. They're beautiful. They have a beautiful sheen or a beautiful, you know, texture. But in the water, they don't always move the way, you know, a natural food form moves. I just recently in a fly fishing and fly tying journal article wrote about particularly steelhead fishing, but flies should have a passive action and a positive action in the sense that, or involuntary action, where that as they're drifting along the current or sitting in on a still water, they move even though the fly is not animated itself. It's moving. In other words, it has some textures. It looks like it's breathing or in one way or the other undulating. And then the other thing is that when you impart action with the rod or the line strip, you know, they also wiggle and they have or swim or have a natural movement action with that imparted action too, with as much as you can possibly get out of it. And, you know, the things that work great like that are materials like marabou.
Right.
That no matter what you do, that material is going to be working or moving in the water like a living creature. You know.
Now, Pete had another question that said, I want to know if there's a particular process you have in designing a fly.
Well, usually, I absolutely love to, you know, to pick out a food that the fish are feeding on. That's one of the nice things that moving back here to Oklahoma, that a lot of these fish here are feeding on different food forms than they did in Arkansas, and it's given me a whole new fly tying challenge to design flies, you know, that work well for the different food forms that are here, or the different sizes and different species of food forms that are here. And so usually what I do is say, well, what's the food for them? What's the size it should be? And then I look for materials, obviously just like a sculpture or an artist would look for colors of paint to simulate that. And once I do that, sometimes I'll do a crude sketch of the fly with sort of design the shape of it and then the materials, and then I'll begin to tie the fly. And the very best thing to do like that is have an aquarium handy, you know, rather large aquarium, say 25 to 100 gallon aquarium, and or be able to go out and fish that fly as you develop it, you know, as you develop its shape and size and color and texture, et cetera. And here in my backyard, I've got the pond and then, of course, the Trout Creek. And then only a quarter mile away, I've got a beautiful smallmouth stream, Caney Creek. So I have a perfect test lab, too. And I really like to do that. I like to take a fly and tie and fish, or tie and try, tie and try, tie and try two or three times until I get it right.
And do you, and it sounds like you tend towards the natural materials first, try to find a solution?
I think most natural materials, what I'm saying natural materials, you know, hackles and bucktails and natural debbings, what have you. We've used them for so many years because they have the natural textures or the natural actions in the water. Synthetics came along, you know, a lot later, and some of the synthetics are excellent as far as their shapes and colors and being transparent and readily available and reasonable, but some of them just don't have that natural movement I was talking about, and you pretty well have to impart that movement if you're going to get it out of some of the flies with some of the coarser synthetic hairs.
And I'm going to bump back here. We're going to come right back to fly tying, but this is a follow-up question on what we were talking about earlier, and I think it's a good question. Mm-hmm. Ed Hewden in Byfield, Massachusetts asks, please clarify how you distinguish a cool water fishery. I'm not familiar with that term.
Okay.
I always place largemouth, smallmouth as a warm water fishery. So what species will I find in cool water fisheries?
Well, there's actually four separate groups of fisheries based on the temperature of the water that these species, you know, feed most aggressively, or their metabolism is highest at. And that's cold water fishery, which is 45 to 65. Cool water fishery, which is 55 to 75. And then warm water fisheries, which is around 70 to 80 to 85. And then, of course, tropical fisheries from about 70 to 90. Cool water fish primarily are smallmouth bass, the perch family, which are walleye, sauger, and yellow perch. The temperate bass family basically prefer cooler water. They spawn in 55 to 60 degree water, et cetera. The pike family, muskie, great northern pike, and pickerel are all cool water fish.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's why we're all, you know, we're talking northern Minnesota, Wisconsin for those pike and...
Yeah. You know, what's remarkable is there's one fish that's basically all of those. Can you guess which it is?
All of those fish.
There's one species of fish that basically does well in all those temperatures.
Smallmouth?
No, that's a good guess, but smallmouth are pretty temperature tolerant, but it's the carp.
Oh, carp. But,
yeah, carp can actually be frozen temporarily, and they can live up into water temperatures to 115 degrees. And they'll feed, you know, they live successfully in a trout stream or a tropical stream.
Wow, yeah. And they're an ancient type of fish, too, aren't they?
Well,
I think they
you
go
know,
back.
The way they describe them is that they're a highly evolved fish. I don't know whether that means ancient or not, but they actually have more, you know, they display a higher degree of evolution than even a trout does.
Yeah, and we did a show on fishing for carp with Brad Beefus that if people want to look in our archive, they can listen in on, and he covers that quite thoroughly. And that's definitely a new kind of, I don't want to call it a fad, I think it's a new direction of fly fishing that a lot of people are taking now is for the carp. So,
well, I'll tell you, they're wonderful fish. We have so much fun with them, and they're just pretty well available to most anybody that fishes cool, to warm water. and, yeah, and in large, yeah, large numbers and large sizes, and you don't really have very much competition whenever you show up on a stream to carp fish. You know, not too many people are going to get in your way. In fact, if you tell them you're going to carp fish, sometimes they get out of your way.
Yeah, yeah.
Thinking you're a little crazy or something.
There's carp fishing in basically downtown Denver here in the Platte,
yeah,
River.
Wow.
And there's 20-30 pound carp down there.
Yeah.
And you're fishing amongst the high rises almost, but they're, yeah, right there in the middle of the city. So,
yeah,
another opportunity. Well, Ed had another just kind of comment I think is kind of interesting. He says, Dave, I tie commercially, and I had a customer who wanted a trout-colored lefty deceiver in 1/0, and he was from Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
Now I know what he was after, stripers.
So. Yeah, probably stripers, or once in a while the big brown trout will, you know, they'll feed on the stalkers, and so it should be also for that, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like you got to be prepared with a lot of flies to fish the area that you're in with all the different kinds of fish there as well.
Oh, yeah. On the lower Illinois that we've talked about frequently here on the show, there's several guides down there that actually maintain their own live boxes with trout in them. They go up in Missouri and buy trout, and they buy them from about 8 inches to about 15 inches, and they use those trout live. It's legal to do that in Oklahoma. In fact, when I first moved here, I don't know if it's still the law or not, but they said on the Illinois fishery that you could keep 6 trout a day, but only 3 of which could be used for live bait.
It's interesting.
Yeah, now I didn't see that in the rule book this year. I don't know whether they changed it or not, but I thought that was one of the most unusual rules I've ever heard about bait.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever seen that in Colorado. Well, Ted in Newington, Connecticut asks, how do you decide on the materials to use when designing a new pattern? And the second question, how do you keep your flex cement from drying out so quickly?
Okay, well, again, you know, I usually keep quite a large selection of fly tying materials. I have my favorites, obviously, but normally, you know, I will kind of experiment around, of course, having tied thousands of flies designed, you know, hundreds of them. I kind of know when I see the side of a rainbow trout fry or if I see a crawfish or something and I want to imitate it, I sort of know what materials I'm going to have to, you know, to put together to accumulate, you know, to be able to tie that fly. So it's almost a foregone conclusion to me as soon as I make up my mind what I want to imitate. And the flex cement thing, because that bottle has that polypropylene insert you can put a bodkin point into, it's not integrity to evaporate is very bad. And the only way you can possibly offset that with to transfer the flex cement into another bottle or regularly dilute it with xylene, which is the thinner that you buy for flex cement. But it's just the way the bottle's shaped and the convenience of that little bodkin insert in there that causes it to evaporate.
And that's not airtight with that bodkin in there.
No,
is what you're saying.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, would you, for young tires, people just getting started, not necessarily young in age, but beginning tires, I should say.
New tires, yeah.
New tires. Would you suggest, it sounds like you'd suggest trying to work with as many different materials as you can so that you can become kind of intuitive about your selection.
Well, within reason of your budget and your accessibility, yeah. When I first fly that I tied out a piece of thread and some blades of grass when I was about 7 years old, and it worked pretty good for bluegill in a local park pond, but on a cane pole because I ran out of bait. But just accumulate, you know, some of the basic materials or the standard materials, and then add to those materials as new ones come out or as you can afford to purchase bits and pieces of new materials. And also, I'm always on the lookout to gather materials. Anytime in the wintertime that I go into a restaurant and they have a cloakroom there, I always kind of look to see if there's any nice feathers or hair on coats there. And, usually during the meal, I'll kind of excuse myself and I'll go in there and clip some of that off. And that's been that's been a wonderful source of materials for me over the years. I've been shot at a couple times and beat up a time or two, but yeah, it's worth it to get good materials.
I hope you aren't listed publicly in the phone book, because there's going to be a lot of women in Arkansas looking for your address, trying to track you down.
I'm just teasing, but you know, road kills and excess of materials from hunters and what have you is always a great source of hair and feather and stuff.
Sure. Well, we have another question from Ken Myers in Oklahoma. He's in Ardmore. I don't know if that's by you or not.
Yeah, south and a little bit west of us.
Okay, he'd like to know your opinion on adding rattles to bass flies. He says he notices that they're added many conventional lures, but what about flies? Is noise important?
Well, first of all, I think noise is important. I think that adding a rattle to a bass fly, if you can do it aesthetically and practically, it probably enhances the bass fly's effectiveness. On the other hand, I have not seen flies that I've tied with rattles on them catch any more fish than flies that I've tied without rattles on them.
Okay.
Personally, bass though feed, you know, a great deal, particularly in murky water or water that's dark or water that's restricted from with their sight, like vegetation, with their lateral line sensor and their inner ear. They hear a lot of food entry or movement in the water, and that usually if a fly is, you know, like a topwater fly is putting out a wake or making a popping or gurgling sound, I think that's a great attractor to them. Also, the way the fly hits the water gives a food profile to a bass. And if you've got a hair bug that's shaped like a frog and you drop it on the water like a frog jumping in, I think that's a wonderful added ability for that fly to create that kind of a noise. And then when they move through the water, if they're relatively bulky, at least the front end of them, they put out a large, you know, low frequency sound profile that bass pick up with their lateral line, and they will really get turned on into that too. The book says that a bass can detect, you know, an object moving through the water up to approximately 22 feet, I think it is, by their lateral line sensor. So,
wow.
And that would be like another fish moving through the water.
Wow. That is impressive.
They can detect, and all fish basically can, with their lateral line sensor, can detect, the general size of the object, the speed of movement, and the direction of movement with that lateral line sensor.
Much more complicated than they seem, huh?
Yeah, and you know, when I was a kid living here in Oklahoma, most of our water was quite murky, and I was always amazed when we cast out into a murky pond or something, and a bass would come 4, 5, 6 feet, just come right over and hit that lure, and I thought, just in my ignorance, that they were seeing it. And then when I got a face mask and fins and started doing some diving, I was shocked at how, you know, you couldn't see very far in that water at all. But I just thought, well, maybe from underneath they could see further, but that's not true. What they were doing was hearing the sound profile of it and coming to it with that. And when the spinnerbaits, you know, first came out, they were just a revolution in murky water fishing or nighttime fishing, because they put out such a strong sound profile. And I don't think you can buy hardly a crankbait lure now that doesn't have a rattle in it.
Yeah.
So maybe we're good.
Yeah. Dennis Jones, Lakeside, Arizona. Dave, what's your favorite glue for attaching eyes to your poppers and streamers?
You know, I went through a lot of glues trying to find one that worked well on particularly attaching eyes to things like a feather surface or clipped deer hair. And the one that I've settled on is a rubber cement that's basically, it's called G-O-O-P or Zapagoo, Z-A-P-A-G-O-O. They're both essentially the same material, but they're a viscous rubber cement that you just put a drop about half the size of the eyeball in on the fly or in the socket of the head of the fly, and then you just push the little eye into that, and that holds it really well.
Okay, great. Question from Rod in Amarillo, Texas. He says, your hair bugs are the best that I have ever seen. What is the name of your video that shows the techniques of tying hair bugs?
It's Tying Bass Flies by Dave Whitlock, and that is a Bass Pro tape.
Oh, so at any Bass Pro, you could get through Bass Pro?
Yeah, if they have a problem, find them at Bass Pro. They can get it on our website. I don't know. I haven't checked with Bass Pro lately to see if they still carry that or not. But it's tying a hair bug, it's tying a hair diver, it's tying the sheet metal series, and then the hair jig series. So it's a topwater, a diver, a swimmer, and a bottom bouncing fly, all on a two-part tape.
Okay. Why don't you give out your website address, Dave, because so if people want to look at your writing, your videos, your artwork, and so forth, what is that website address?
It's just www.davewhitlock.com.
That's easy to remember, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty simple, isn't it?
Yeah, so there you go, folks. If you want to see more about Dave, that's a
We've got a nice
place.
Website.
Yeah.
We're always welcome inquirers.
Yeah, great. Okay, I need to take a quick break again here, and then we'll come back in just a minute and continue. Attention fly fishers, are you aware of the proposed Pebble Mine project in southwest Alaska? This enormous open pit would generate as much as 3 billion tons of waste in a seismic area with some of the most important trout and Pacific salmon fisheries in all of Alaska, or in the world for that matter. The well-being of Lake Iliamna and the entire Bristol Bay area waters may be at stake. If you have not already, acquaint yourself with the concerns. You can make a difference, and the ramifications reach far beyond fly fishing. Go to www.bristolbayalliance.com or Google Bristol Bay Mining. Get involved, be proactive, and protect our environment and the future of fly fishing. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dave Whitlock about his world of fly fishing. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, go to our homepage, fill out that text box, and send it in. We'll try to answer as many of the questions on our show tonight as possible. Well, let's see what we've got still here with flies before we move on. This question, you can sort this one out, Dave. Why do you use so many kinds of glues on your flies? This is from Gary Powell in Memphis.
Well, Gary, the reason I use so many kinds is that a number of years ago, of course, being a chemist anyway, I've always been interested, you know, in the chemistry of glues and what have you. But a number of years ago, I was writing a regular column for Fly Tire magazine, and one of the columns that I wrote was a study I made on really how each cement that we use in fly tying truly works on hair and on feathers and on hard materials and on thread and what have you. And so I set up a series of experiments where I have four or five different surfaces that I put a drop of glue on, and then I would put a piece of material on that drop of glue, or in that drop of glue. And after it hardened or after it set up, then I would pull on the material to see if it would pull out of the glue or disengage from the material. Some of the material was aluminum, some was metal, some was wood, etc. And I discovered that different materials glued to different different surfaces adhere differently depending on the type of glue you use. And basically, that when you're gluing something, when you're fixing something to a flexible material that is flexible itself, the more flexible the cement is, the better it works. Once in a while, you need a very hard bonding cement to hold like a hook into a body of a fly, like a popping bug. So going from the various parts of a fly or the different types of fly, I vary the glue according to that study that I made.
Terrific. Question from Captain Sid Carradine in Columbus, Mississippi. He says he's currently fly fishing on the Tennessee Tombigbee waterway for bass and bream, using a type of fly spinner that a fly tire made up for me. Question is, would the same flies that use up in the Illinois River work down this far south?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, you know, that bass and brim just about anywhere are going to be feeding on the same things, and that's minnows and crawfish and insects and leeches, you know, and worms, et cetera. And I think probably that once in a while, because there maybe are more threadfin shad or there's more mayflies or what have you, one fly seems to be consistently better than another. But I'll guarantee you that the flies that we use here on the Illinois River and the Ozark, these Ozark streams here would work real well there too.
Okay, another question. Mark Raymond in Longmont, Colorado. He says he's leaving Friday to Port O'Connor, Texas.
Yeah, that's redfish country.
He wants to know if you have any favorite redfish flies.
Well, you know, I'm not a real active redfish. I get to go redfishing maybe about once every two or three years, and that area that he's talking about down there, we were just down there not too long ago. I think it was last fall, and one of the flies that I like real well to fish down there with is my red fox squirrel nymph tied with bead eyes and rubber legs in about a size 6 or a size 4. It looks an awful lot like a crab or a shrimp. Other than the standard redfish flies, that would probably be one of the ones that I've used. A number of years ago, we were fishing at Tampa Bay, Emily and I would have to do a program, and we walked out onto a redfish flat, and I was not prepared to redfish. I hadn't expected to get an opportunity to redfish, and that morning before we took our flight out, we got an invitation to run out for 2 or 3 hours of redfishing. And the only fly that I had with me that seemed to be, you know, well designed enough to catch redfish was my near enough crawfish. And sure enough, it just worked like a charm. Just hopped along the bottom, and I guess it looked like a saltwater crab or snapping shrimp, but whatever it was, the redfish found great favor with it that morning, and I was really pleased with the results of it.
Well, we have a question came in from Vic Robards. He says he lives in Shangri-La on Monkey Island, Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
There's several ponds on the golf course there loaded with large carp. How do I catch them?
Well, you know, probably those are the white Amur carp. They're probably not what we call the common carp. And they're more of a true vegetarian than the big wild carp or big yellow carp. I've heard a number of people say they do real well on anything that looks like a grass clipping, because as they mow around those golf course hazards and what have you, they, you know, a lot of grass clippings go into the pond, and those carp really eat those. And so that might be one thing. What I've had my best luck with, other than that, on catching those big grass carp, with a small sponge spider, about a size 10 sponge spider, or a denzel, an olive denzel fly nymph in about a size 8 or size 10, you know, cast to the fish as it's moving along, you know, well ahead of it, and so they can intercept it. Emily was fishing on Crooked Creek in Arkansas several years ago, and she saw a giant white Amur swimming by, 35 or 40 pounds, and she had a little chartreuse and black brim popper, and she cast it ahead of the fish, and it took it. I mean, just like it was a piece of candy. So just keep in mind they eat all kinds of plants, all kinds of flowers and seeds that fall in the water, because that's all, you know, in a vegetarian mode. And I would guess that would probably be the best advice I could give on what flies to use.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, because we've got a few questions here about some techniques and strategies and casting. And I'm going to try to combine these. Nielsen in Northern California, I don't know if that's his name or where this person is from, but he wants you to describe your favorite fly fishing outfit, and I guess for fishing the kind of waters that you fish there. And maybe you can address also Joanne Whitley in St. Louis Obispo, California's question, because she's talking about trying to cast to bass an overlined pen weight bass taper line. So maybe you can kind of address all that kind of, you know, what kind of line to use, rig, and so forth.
Well, that's really an extremely broad-based question,
yeah.
Roger. I would say that when I, you know, at the age I am 73, I don't usually use rods over 8 weight anymore. While I'm in reasonably good physical shape, it's just too hard on the joints to try to cast 9 and 10 weight rods for very long. I usually try to use a relatively lightweight 7-weight or 6-weight rod for most of my fishing nowadays, and only when I really need to do I go up to an 8-weight, and that's usually when I'm strapper fishing. If I hook a fish too big for the rod, that's just a high-class problem. I just let him beat me up as bad as he wants to. I used to carry, for my warm and cool water fishing, you know, an 8.5 to 9 foot, 6 or 7 weight kind of a medium fast action rod. I like a little extension butt on it. And for the lines, I use a Bass Bug Taper floating line. I use what I call my quick tip, which is a 5 foot long, a number 3 and number 4 sink tip, and then a full sinking line. You know, full uniform. And those three lines usually suffice for the type of fishing that I like to do. Our friend Billy Butts that we talked about earlier, he fishes a lot of these Arkansas and Oklahoma and Missouri rivers for white bass and for strappers, and he prefers to use a 10-foot number 3 a sink tip line for most of his streamer fishing. And so we might add that a bit longer sink tip to round out the four lines.
And let's see,
one thing, this question to Joanne. You know, I would advise her to get a rod that has a more of a mid-flex action. The rod that she's talking about here, an 8-foot rod, excuse me, an 8-weight rod at eight-something feet, and she just can't seem to cast the thing, even overloading the line. Sounds to me like it's just too stiff a rod for her ability and for her natural action. And I would get a rod, and the rod she mentioned that she could cast are softer rods. And so, if she wants to fish with a sage rod, she might just get one that has a little bit more mid flex to it.
There you go. Well, let's see here. What do we have left? Do you use any shooting heads on fishing for smallies or stripers? And if so, do you use this knotless Zappa-Gap connection that you use for standard leader connections?
I only really use shooting heads when I need to cast long distances. I prefer just standard weight forward lines for most of my casting. But if I do use a shooting head, I normally use some form of the Zappa-Gap connection to connect the shooting line with the head, whether it's with a loop-to-loop Zappa-Gap connection or whether I just go ahead and splice the line right to the shooting line right to the head, whether it's monofilament or you know, the shooting fly line. But yeah, I do about 8 or 10 different connections with that Zappa-Gap material, and all of them basically give you an extremely smooth, small, 100% strong connection. And if you're really trying to, you know, refine your line system, adding the Zappa-Gap connections certainly does eliminate an enormous amount of problems that you get with tangles and hang-ups and what have you.
Now, I guess this is what this Jeff Moody in Houston, Texas is talking about.
This
came in online while we were talking. It says, a little off topic, would you ask Dave when the DVD on the knotless leader fly line connection is coming out? Is there an animal like that?
We're working on one now. In fact, what it will be all of those connections and a number of other different Zappa-Gap bonding methods with fly tying. Emma and I are working with the Zap people now to produce a DVD that will scope all of those products that are kind of in that super glue family.
And so people should just kind of watch your website.
Yeah, just hang out.
Yeah. Another question, Dr. Michael Myers in Amarillo, Texas. He wants to know what your opinion on fly line color is, and is there any benefit to one color over another that you found?
That's a good question. It's a broad question. I think probably that when you're learning how to fly fish, you know, the better you can see the line, the more fish and the better you're going to learn how to cast. As you become a better caster, a more accurate caster, more proficient caster, the less the fish can see the line, particularly in the air, the more fish you're going to catch. And so once you kind of get over having to watch that line or see the line to improve your casting, then I would tend to go to a more somber, a more neutral color line, like a gray or an olive, or a brown line that doesn't scare the fish quite as much in the air as well as on the water. I think most of the time, people scare or frighten fish with two things on a fly line. One, the line, flashing above the fish in the air when the water's clear, relatively shallow, or maybe a calm surface. That can frighten fish something terrible. The other thing is that when someone makes a relatively splashy cast, particularly where the line and leader connection is concerned, that makes an enormous amount of noise when it hits the water. You don't see the fish react to it, but the fish can hear it. And I think that if you got the fish looking at your line tip rather than the fly, because it makes more noise than the fly does when it hits the water, you're not going to catch nearly as many fish. My old adage to all of our students is that if you want a fish to eat, don't scare him before you ask him to eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, we're running out of time here, but I did want to ask you one final question that we'll close out with, and then we'll do our drawing.
Final one, okay.
Yeah, final one. The question is, what do you feel your contribution to, your best contribution to the fly fishing world has been over your lifetime? Is there any one particular thing that you would pick out?
Well, I think since I came from a Sahara Desert fly fishing state with a blue collar family that weren't fly fishermen, with the fact that I've been able to show that to people that anyone who wants to can become a fly fisherman and enjoy it. It's a sport for everybody, and I think I've tried to all my life with my example show people that no matter who you are, how much money you have, or where you come from, that fly fishing is certainly within the realm of possibility if you just want to do it and just get out there and get you some tackle and practice it. Along that line, if someone getting ready to get into fly fishing, decide how much money or you can afford to get into it. Spend half of that first, and I emphasize first, on instruction, and then take the other half and buy your tackle.
And good advice.
And I think I just think that will be the best way in the world to become a fly fisherman.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Well, let's hang in here, Dave, with me, because we're going to do the drawings in just a minute.
Okay.
So, everybody, we're going to give away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and the subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine and that $20 gift certificate. So stay tuned to see if you win. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout, flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. And that's Reeling, A-N-D, Healing, Midwest.org. Or call 866-237-5725. It's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You'll find the link on our homepage in Dave's section there that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. And the first thing we're going to do is give away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. which is always a great gift. And if you'd like to learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, it's their website is www.fedflyfishers.org. www.fedflyfishers.org. So I'm going to do our drawing from our database. If you didn't get into this by now, it's too late, but make sure you register on the next show because we're always giving away some great prizes. I'm going to pick a winner here for that federation. This is randomly selected from our database. And I've got Rory Wisk in Kansas. Rory Wisk. Well, congratulations, Rory. I'm sure you'll enjoy the membership. Terrific. Okay. I'm just trying to write this down so I remember it. And then the second drawing we're going to do is for a subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. Fly Fusion Magazine is out of Calgary, Canada, and their website is flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. And the winner for that is Rob Kamenzind. Rob Kamenzind, and he's, oddly enough, up in Alberta. So we have a Canadian magazine going out to a Canadian. How good can that get? So congratulations, Rob. We'll get your subscription going. And then our final gift tonight is the $20 gift certificate, compliments of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. Their website is www.frontrangeanglers.com. Now, if you win this, you can redeem this online at their website as well. You don't have to come to Boulder. Of course, that's not a bad thing either. But anyway, that's how you can do this. And I also wanted to, as I'm clearing my queue here, want to thank everybody for sending in their questions tonight. They were great questions. We, of course, didn't get to all of them, as per usual, and really makes the show lively, and I appreciate that. Now, the question I'm going to ask, and you've got to submit the first correct answer in that text box on our homepage to win this, and you have to put in your name and your location as well. If you forget that, then you'll be disqualified. So the question, and Dave's going to determine what the correct answer is on this, and I'll just tell you as they come in here, Dave. So,
okay.
Now, I got this question wrong tonight already, so there's your hint. What is the fish that crosses the most different temperature type waters and survives in most of the different temperature types, cold water, warm water, cool water, and so forth, even tropical? What is the name of that fish? That should be pretty easy, huh, Dave?
Yeah. For some people it would be, particularly if you're a carpaholic, like I.
Oh, there he gave it away, yeah. Well, I'm looking up. We got somebody, Ted Christie in Parker, Colorado.
Yeah.
Ted Christie in Parker, Colorado. And Ted gets that $20, so he can go to Boulder and redeem that if he'd like. So.
He could also get some carp in Colorado, too.
Oh, yeah. A lot of carp
in Colorado.
Yeah. So, Ted, congratulations. Thanks for helping me out on that, Dave.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And thank you, Dave, you know, for being on the show tonight. I really appreciate it, and I know our listeners appreciated it. It's wonderful to have you, and I hope you enjoyed it as well.
Well, I did, Roger. It's always good to talk to a group of fly fishermen, you know, about this sport. It's my passion. It's my love. It's been my life for so many years. I'm so blessed to be able to participate in such a great sport. And I hope to be doing it another 25 years at least.
Well, I hope so, too, and can't wait to see what your future contributions are already. I mean, in the future, you've already contributed so much.
Speaking of future contributions, check out Fly Fisherman Magazine, the fall issue. There's a 10th anniversary issue of Stalking the Golden Ghost carp issue. And they told me that it's going to be the largest layout that they've ever had in a magazine. So
that shows. And this is upcoming this fall.
Yeah. It should be either the next issue or the following one.
Okay.
And it'll be on a 10-year update on fly rotting for carp.
Well, terrific. Good. We got an inside scoop on that one.
Yes.
Thanks, Dave.
Uh-huh.
Well, our next broadcast will be on May 21st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to interview Renee Lamaris. We've had Renee on the show before. And this time, we're going to be talking with him on Kamchatka, trout fishing's next frontier. Renee's a professional guide, takes you to Kamchatka where there are still more fish than people. It may be the next and last frontier for fly fishers seeking huge trout and salmon. Join Renee and I and discover what it takes to land the big ones in Russia. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic Outfitters, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, please give us a call at 888-961-1115 extension 2, and we'd be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.